Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 1 through 25, which I shall entitle Exclusions from the Assembly and Miscellaneous Laws. Our context is this. Moses is speaking to the Israelites on the plains of Moab in his second discourse before the Israelites are getting ready to pass over after his death into the Promised Land. Our previous chapter covered miscellaneous laws again, and more particularly laws concerning sexual immorality. So we start now in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 1. No one who is emasculated or has his male organ cut off shall enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, emasculated is translated in a wonderful way in the King James Version, wounded in the stones. So no one who is wounded in the stones shall enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, these people are basically eunuchs, and before you feel too sorry for the eunuchs, let's see that later on eunuchs got blessings in later times in the history of Israel. Isaiah 56, 4 through 5, "For thus says the Lord to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, to them I will give in my house and within my walls a memorial and a name better than that of sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name which will not be cut off." So you see, even people that have disabilities are blessed in the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. We look also at Acts 8, verses 34 through 39 in the New Testament. The Ethiopian eunuch answered Philip and said, "Please tell me, of whom does the prophet say this, of myself or of someone else?" And then, to shorten up the story a little bit, Philip preached the gospel to him. And the eunuch said, "There's water, let me get baptized." Philip said, "You may, if you believe that Christ is the Son of God." And so Philip, as well as the eunuch, went down in the water and got baptized. So the eunuch was blessed with salvation. Now, who was it? Who were these people who were not allowed to enter into the assembly of the Lord? Well, it could be those who were emasculated, who were wounded in the stones on purpose, which is a very ancient practice in the East. Parents would train their kids. They had a view to training their kids for service in the houses of the great, so they would emasculate them and say, "Okay, I'm going to train you to work in the king's service, and you will be ready because you've been emasculated all your life," which to me is kind of disgusting. But Matthew Poole says that one of the purposes of this law here is to discourage that heathen practice. You're not going to enter into the assembly if you're emasculated, so don't think that you can cut your kid's privates off to get him to serve in the assembly, and that would assume that the assembly meant the judicial assembly, the legal assembly, the assembly of the elders, not the whole congregation, which we'll talk about in a minute. Or it could refer to those who were wounded in the stones by accident, or it could include both. It does include both. Now, these who are emasculated should not enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, here's some options as to what the assembly means. It could mean the tabernacle sanctuary. But John Gill says it can't mean that. Even alien proselytes were allowed into the courts of the sanctuary. Why would you let emasculated people not come in? Especially if it was through no fault. Well, it is through no fault of their own, most probably. 99.99% of the time, it was done to them. They didn't do it to themselves. That's option number one. The tabernacle sanctuary is what is meant by assembly. Option number two, assembly means the Commonwealth of Israel. But the problem with that is, as Matthew Poole says, as John Gill says, it's hard to think that being emasculated would deprive one of his civil rights and privileges. Matthew Poole agrees with Gill and says this, quote, "It were absurd to think that any of the Israelites with such a natural or involuntary defect should be shut out from all God's ordinances, nor so that they were to be put out of the muster roll of God's people, or to lose the privileges common to all Israelites, to wit, the benefit of the year of release or jubilee, which it is not probable the Israelites were to forfeit merely for this unculpable perfection." Unculpable is an old-fashioned word. It means they weren't guilty for this. They were born that way, or it was done to them. Why should we kick them out of the Commonwealth of Israel, the whole nation? All right, so that's option number two, and I don't think first two options are very good. The sanctuary, option one, the whole Commonwealth of Israel, option two. But here's option number three. The assembly here means elders and judges in their judicial capacity. As John Gill mentions, and Adam Clark actually affirms that option. Now, why might the elders of Israel in their judicial capacity might not want to have eunuchs among them? Because the symbolism is not good. Just like a priest has to represent God in his perfection, likewise a judge does too. If you recall, priests who were emasculated were not allowed to be priests. There was no such thing. They weren't allowed. A member of the house of Aaron, of the family of Aaron, if he was emasculated, could not be a priest. As Adam Clark and Matthew Poole say, the contempt for the personal defect might be transferred to the office, and people might say, that guy's a eunuch, and he's judging my law case. That would be a concession to the nastiness of human beings, I guess. Matthew Poole says another reason why it might not be nice to have eunuchs as elders in Israel, because eunuchs tended to become effeminate, irresolute, and lacking courage. Now, that's actually true. Sometimes you read enough Eastern or ancient Near Eastern or history of the East, the eunuchs do tend to get sort of laid back, but not always. How about the eunuchs in the Ming Dynasty? They took over the whole country. Well, Poole and others who think like him say that, hey, maybe the eunuchs don't have the balls to carry out civil punishments, if you'll excuse the expression. Because after all, judges sometimes have to inflict capital punishment on people. Maybe eunuchs wouldn't have the guts to do that because they're effeminate. Or it could be just to distinguish the Israelites from the surrounding nations, because it was common for surrounding heathens to admit eunuchs to their civil offices. Well, I look askance at these views that say that eunuchs are effeminate and can't do things. What I think in the, what was it, the Ottoman Empire, the Janissaries, if I remember correctly, they were eunuchs who took over the whole flipping government, and the sultans became, they were the ones that became weak and effeminate. So I don't think so. I think the best answer is that eunuchs as judges would distinguish Israel from the surrounding heathen nations. Now, here's what Matthew Poole says about that. He agrees with this. He says, quote, howsoever, seeing they are oft called the congregation, the assembly, the congregation, they may very well, and the they there is referring to the elders of Israel, the judges, the people in charge, they may very well be called in a special manner the congregation of the Lord, because they were appointed by God and act in his name instead, and for his work and service, and did also oft assemble near the tabernacle where God was eminently present. Add to this that the Hebrew word kahal generally signifies a congregation or company of men met together, and therefore this cannot so conveniently be meant of all the body of the people, which could never meet in one place, but of the chief rulers, which frequently did so. So that's what I'm going to go with. No emasculated person wounded in his stones could be an elder or judge in Israel. Here's some scripture showing that congregation or assembly, the English translation for that, refers to elders only, not the whole congregation. Numbers 35:12, you will have the cities as refuge from the avenger, so that the one who kills someone will not die until he stands trial before the assembly. Well, obviously, nobody's going to stand trial before the whole jillions of people in Israel, but only before the judges, the assembly of the judges. Numbers 35:24-25. The assembly is to judge between the slayer and the avenger of blood. The assembly is to protect the one who kills someone from the hand of the avenger of blood. Then the assembly will return him to the city of refuge. That's obviously not the whole nation of Israel. That's the legal assembly, the bench, if you will, the assembly of elders, the assembly of the judges. Joshua 20:6, he is to stay in that city until he stands trial before the assembly. All of these verses referring to the city of refuge, the cities of refuge. And the manslayer is tried there in Joshua 26 before the assembly of judges. Joshua 29, these are the cities appointed for all the Israelites and foreigners among them, so that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there and not die at the hand of the avenger of blood until he stands before the assembly. And the assembly there is obviously a court, not the whole nation. So, just to summarize verse 1, which is kind of complicated, a man emasculated, wounded in his stones, could not be a judge or an elder of Israel, if my interpretation is correct, and I believe it is. We go now to Deuteronomy 23:2. No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord. And no one of illegitimate birth, it's translated more earthly by the King James Version, is no bastard. No bastard shall enter the assembly of the Lord. What was the purpose of this law? Jameson Fawcett Brown says the purpose was to erect a barrier against adultery. If an adulterer knew that if he got the girl pregnant, that son would never be a judge. In other words, would never rise to prominence in Israel, so that would tend to be a check on adultery. And that sounds good, but what about the poor, pitiful, illegitimate child who was a bastard through no fault of his own? Well, an answer to that would be this. This law didn't mean that the bastard could not be a member of the congregation. It's just that he couldn't be a ruling or judging elder, just like he couldn't be a priest. That's not the end of the world. Now, the bastards referred to could be different kinds of bastards. They could be bastards that came from adultery, as Gillen Clark mentioned, or they could be bastards that came from incest. People married within the bounds of consanguinity, as they used to say in the Middle Ages when all those noblemen were always marrying their nieces and their first cousins and such. Well, whatever. However you came to be a bastard, your descendants to the 10th generation could not enter the assembly, and I'm assuming that's the judges again, an assembly of judges. That 10th generation could be metaphorical, not literal, because 10, as you know, as the NIV Study Bible says, is a symbol of completeness or finality. It's used all the time in the Old Testament, so it could mean the 10th generation means forever. In other words, you produce a bastard in Israel, that bastard's descendants are going to be excluded from the leadership of Israel forever. And I'll tell you a verse here that kind of proves that that's what it means. Nehemiah 13:1. On that day they read in the book of Moses in the audience of the people, and therein was found written that the Ammonite and the Moabite should not come into the congregation of God forever, forever. So Nehemiah 13:1 has forever, but now Deuteronomy 23:3 says, no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the Lord's assembly, none of their descendants, even to the 10th generation. So there you have forever and 10th generation in perfect parallel with each other, talking about the same subject, Ammonites and Moabites not entering into the assembly. One verse Nehemiah has forever, and another verse, Deuteronomy 23, has 10th generation. So I'm going to assume that that means bastards are excluded forever. Now, when I say forever, that means as long as Israel existed as a nation, which ended in AD 70, of course. It doesn't mean into eternity, world without end. Now, this idea that 10th means forever is the usual interpretation, according to John Gill, and I point out that a literal interpretation, at least to me, would seem to be arbitrary. If you're going to exclude to the 10th generation, why not the 11th generation? What's so special about 10? But again, the whole purpose of all this, excluding emasculated people, excluding bastards, is to make Israel separate. The leadership of Israel is not profane. We go now to Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 6. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. Nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loves you. You shall never seek their peace or their prosperity all your days. Now, first of all, verse 3 says, no Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. The NIV Study Bible says Ruth is the outstanding exception to the exclusion. Well, so I asked the question, why was she allowed the exception? Why did no one complain? Well, here are options, four options to answer, the first three of which are from John Gill, and I've got an option to add for number four. So option number one is, this restriction against Moabites being in the assembly applied only to men. And again, here we got that same question, does assembly mean the whole nation, or does it mean the assembly of the elders? If it means the assembly of the elders, then the NIV Study Bible is stating something that is irrelevant to say that Ruth is an exception to the exclusion, because obviously Ruth's not going to be a member of the elders. She's got no interest in that. Plus, she's a woman. The elders were male. So I'm assuming the NIV Study Bible here takes assembly as the whole nation of Israel, and that Ruth was an exception to the exclusion of the whole nation of Israel. Well, here's how we can explain Ruth being allowed into Israel. The restriction against Moabites entering was only to the men, not to the women. It doesn't say Ammonites shall not enter into the assembly of the Lord. It says Ammonites. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that many eminent writers think that this law of exclusion was applicable only to males. Well, that's option number one as to how Ruth got in under the exception. Option number two, she entered Israel as a proselyte, not a Moabite. In other words, she renounced her nation of Moab so that she could become a Jewish proselyte. Maybe. Option number three, assembly means the elders of Israel, not the whole congregation, as we assumed was true in the case of bastards and people wounded in the stones. But here, the advantage of that interpretation is the word assembly keeps the same meaning all the way through. And it could be, and it could very well be, that you don't have foreigners in the courts, in the rulership of your cities. Well, if that's the case, well, obviously it's not going to refer to Ruth because she's not a candidate for being an elder of the city. And option number four, it could be the law was simply not obeyed. Ruth came in illegally. She was an illegal alien, and nobody said anything about it. I mean, after all, we got millions and millions of illegal aliens in America right now. Nobody seems to care. Maybe that's what happened back then, too. Now you might ask, why would Ammonites and Moabites be excluded from the assembly of the Lord? Well, it had nothing to do with the fact that Moab and Ammon were born in incest. You remember Lot's daughters in the cave at Zoar having escaped from the burning Sodom and Gomorrah. They escaped to that cave, and then they said, oh my goodness, nobody for us to marry. We've got to have children. So they got their father Lot drunk and had sex with him, and twice, actually. And Moab was born of one daughter, I forgot which one, and Ammon was born of the other. But that didn't have anything to do with why they were prohibited from being in the government of Israel or the assembly of Israel. It's because, it states here in verse 4, they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam. Well, in verse 4, it says they did not meet you with food and water. There's a problem here. The Moabites actually did meet the Israelites with food and water. Deuteronomy 2:28 and 29 says so. Verse 28, you, and this is referring to Sihon the Amorite, you, Sihon, can sell us food in exchange for silver so we may eat, and give us water for silver so we may drink. So you, Sihon, can sell us food and water. Only let us travel through on foot, just as the descendants of Esau who live in Seir did for us, and just as the Moabites who live in Ar did for us. So that verse clearly says that the Moabites sold them food and water, but here it says, we're going to exclude Moabites for 10 generations because they did not sell us food and water. Well, how do you explain that? Well, it's actually easier than you might think. These options are from Matthew Poole. I'm going to give you two options, which I don't think are accurate, but I'll give them to you anyway. It was only the Moabites at Ar who refused to sell, not Moabites in general, because our verse here in Deuteronomy 23:4 says, they did not meet you with food and water, but Deuteronomy 2, it says, the Moabites who live in Ar gave us food and water. So the idea is a special subset of the Moabites in Ar gave us food and water, or sold us food and water, but the rest of the Moabites didn't. Well, that's clever, but I don't think it's the way to solve the problem. Here's option number two. In Deuteronomy 23, the Moabites have said that they didn't meet the Israelites with bread and water, but in Deuteronomy 2:28, when the Moabites were said to sell the food and water, that would refer to a time later on. So we distinguish the times. Deuteronomy 23, when the Israelites first showed up on Moabites' water, the Moabites were nice and gave them sold them bread and water. But later, when they tried to go around their territory and they put heat on them and they scared them, they said, no, we're not going to sell to you. That was later on. Well, that's possible. But again, I don't believe that's the answer. Here's the easiest answer. The they in verse 4 only refers to the Ammonites, not the Moabites. So let me read Deuteronomy 23, 3 and 4. This way, no Ammonite or Moabite may ever enter the Lord's assembly. This is because they, referring to the Ammonites now only, the Ammonites did not meet you with food and water on the journey, and because Balaam, the son of Beor, was hired by the Moabites to curse you. So, in other words, the they there in our verse, Deuteronomy 23, verse 4, refers to the Ammonites not selling water, and the Moabites who made a deal with Balaam. Let me put it in a little bit more elegant language. Matthew Poole, the words are to be taken descriptively, and this first member of the verse belongs to the Ammonites who did not meet them with bread, and the latter part to the Moabites, but not with the Ammonites, hired Balaam. That might be hard to follow orally, but it just makes sense. You're talking about two groups, two pagan nations, Ammonites and Moabites, and they did two different things. The Ammonites didn't meet you with food and water. The Moabites made a deal with Balaam, which the Ammonites didn't do. And that's how I solve that problem. Now, the story of Moab and Balaam, of course, has been given already in Numbers 22 through 24. If you recall that story, Balak of Moab hired Balaam, who's up there in Syria. Come on down here. Put a curse on these Israelites. Balaam says, no, I'm not going to do it, but I would like your money. Let me come down and think about it. Looked over the mountains, several mountain peaks that Balak took him. No, can't do it. Got to bless him. And so after that happened in Numbers 23:11, Balak said to Balaam, what have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have actually blessed them. Well, anyway, the Ammonites and the Moabites, for their perfidy, were excluded from Israel's assembly, and I think that means the whole nation. They couldn't become proselytes, I assume, for 10 generations. We see this attitude toward Moab, Ammon, and Edom through the prophets who spent a good deal of time denouncing those three nations. In Isaiah 15 and 16, Jeremiah 48 and 49, Ezekiel 25, Amos 1 and 2, Zephaniah 2, fire and brimstone breathed out upon Moab, Ammon, and Edom. Now, verse 6 says that the Israelites are to never seek their peace. What does it mean to seek their peace? The NIV translates that as, do not seek a treaty of friendship with them. And I think that's exactly what it means, but the enmity between those three nations, Moab, Ammon, and Edom, was not meant to be on a personal basis. David was kind to Hanun the Ammonite. Let me read you a quote from John Gill. Not that they were to retain malice towards them, the Israelites towards the Ammonites, or indulge a spirit of revenge, or not do them any good offices in a private way, which is contrary to the law of love, nor does this contradict any offices of kindness and friendship that might be performed in a personal way. So we find that David had a kindness for Hanun the Ammonite, and showed it, though ill rewarded for it, yet is not blamed for doing it. For these words respect not persons in a private capacity, but the people of Israel as a body politic, who as such were not to carry on trade and commerce with those people, nor intermarry with them, nor make leagues and enter into alliances with them. Now, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's just like, I could understand how the American government would not want to make treaties with the People's Republic of China, because they're run by a bunch of SOBs. They're dangerous. They're dictatorial. They don't give a ding-dong damnable thing about human beings. And I don't like them. But that doesn't mean I don't love Chinese people. I do love Chinese people. I wish I could go back over there, actually. Can't do it because of the aforesaid government. We go down to Deuteronomy 23, 7 through 8. You shall not detest an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not detest an Egyptian, because you were an alien in his land. The sons of the third generation who were born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, the Edomites and the Egyptians didn't get excluded for 10 generations, only for 3 generations. Why? Why was the Edomite excluded for a shorter time? It's because they were related to Israel. Remember, Jacob, his other name was Israel. Jacob, also known as Israel, and Esau, also known as Edom, they were brothers. I say also known as, I guess I should say Esau was the founder of Edom. So Jacob, who was the founder of the 12 tribes of Israel, and Esau, who was the founder of Edom, they were brothers. So therefore, there's less punishment for them. How about the Egyptians? Why were they excluded for a shorter time? Well, they early showed hospitality to the family of Jacob, as we know all through the story in Genesis. Also, private Egyptians showed generosity to the Israelites at the time of the Exodus, Exodus 12:36, and the Lord gave the people such favor in the Egyptian sight that they gave them what they requested. In this way, they plundered the Egyptians. Well, generosity, it might have been extortion, actually, because they wanted to get the Israelites out of Egypt because they thought the Israelites were cursing them because of all the plagues. So I'm not really sure you would, that's really a reason why the Egyptians were awarded a lesser punishment. I think it's probably because they showed hospitality to the family of Jacob when the patriarchs, because of their famine, went down to Israel and Egypt did them well. Now, that third generation, that sounds like a literal three to me. How are the three generations counted? Well, it could be third generations from the time that Moses was making his speech here, or the time that the law was made, which I assume was right here. Or it could have been made back at Mount Sinai, maybe, and just talked about here. Or, well, if it was from Mount Sinai, that was short, that's about a generation from Mount Sinai to the plains of Moab. So I guess there's three options. Three generations from Sinai, three generations from the plains of Moab, or it could be three generations from the time that Israel was embraced by an Egyptian as a proselyte. And you say, okay, you can be a proselyte Egyptian or Ammonite, but you got to wait. You're not your son, not your grandson, but the great-grandson, and then he can enter the assembly of the Lord. But the first you and the first two generations cannot. The reason I have a problem with that is because if you're going to allow the proselyte in the first generation, why would you exclude the sons and the grandsons? I don't think it's referring to proselytes. I think it's people in general, Edomites or Egyptians in general. You got to count three generations. According to this option, three generations from the time that an Egyptian or an Ammonite makes application to enter Israel. I don't think that's it. I think it's three generations either from Sinai or the plains of Moab. That's the easiest way to look at that. We go now to Deuteronomy 23, verses 9 through 11. When you go out as an army against your enemies, then you shall keep yourself from every evil thing. If there is among you any man who is unclean because of a nocturnal emission, then he must go outside the camp. He may not re-enter the camp. But it shall be when evening approaches, he shall bathe himself with water, and at sundown he may re-enter the camp. What every evil thing, what kind of evil things should soldiers keep themselves from? John Gill says things like idolatry, sexual sin, and murder. Gill says that sin right before a battle would produce evil effects. The courage of the soldiers would be weakened because the soldier would be guilt-ridden. God would less likely favor the success of the battle because the people left in sin. And the sinning soldier might soon have to die and face God. He doesn't want to die that way. Well, that makes sense. But then there's another prohibition, verse 10, if there is among you any man who is unclean because of a nocturnal emission, he's got to leave, go outside the camp. He can't come back in. He can take a bath, come back in at night. At sundown, he may re-enter the camp. Now, there's three options as to what unclean means here. Unclean because of sanitation violations. Unclean because of violation of sanitary rules. The NIV Study Bible suggests this. And I respond to that. How is a nocturnal emission unsanitary? Maybe from a disease, maybe? Well, if it's a disease, one day outside the camp taking a bath isn't going to cure it. So I don't think that's it. Here's another option. This is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Moral uncleanness. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, quote, the excesses incident to camp life, as well as from habits of personal neglect and impurity. So what's he thinking? Israelite soldiers shacking up with prostitutes? I don't think that was the case in the Israelite army. So I don't think that's referring to moral uncleanness. I think Gill has it here. Option number three, the uncleanness that should be excluded from the army camp is ritual uncleanness. Semen was associated with life, so nocturnal emissions could not be allowed to go casually unnoticed. Leviticus 15:16, when a man has an emission of semen, he is to bathe himself completely with water, and he will remain unclean until evening. That's in the law, and so this is just following the law. Bathe himself in water, unclean to leave. That's obviously what it is. We go now to Deuteronomy 23, verses 12 through 14. You shall also have a place outside the camp and go out there. And you shall have a spade among your tools, and it shall be when you sit down outside. You shall dig with it and shall turn to cover up your excrement. That sitting down, of course, means to squat down to poop. It doesn't mean to sit in a chair. Since the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to defeat your enemies before you, therefore your camp must be holy, and he must not see anything indecent among you, lest he turn away from you. Now, what is the indecent thing that God shouldn't look at? Well, it could refer to that uncovered over excrement we just mentioned, or it could refer to all the unclean things mentioned from verse 9 to here. For example, nocturnal emissions. Well, that's the only thing mentioned, really. Nocturnal emissions or uncovered up poop. We go now to Deuteronomy 23, verses 15 through 16. You shall not hand over to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall live with you in your midst, in the place which he shall choose, in one of your towns where it pleases him. You shall not mistreat him. Now, there's several ways to interpret this verse. The first problem we have is this handing over. Is this mean you never hand over a runaway slave to his master, or does it mean the slave is handed back to the master only after a period of time has elapsed? This is from John Gill. We'll discuss those two issues in a minute. And also another thing we have to look at here, is this talking about Israelite slaves who've escaped, or is it talking about foreign slaves who have escaped? Well, let's take the first problem first, the handing over. Is it to be option one, the slave is never handed back to the master? Now, in that case, it would only be true if the slave was a foreign slave. You would never give the escaped foreign slave back to his foreign master. However, if it was a Israelite slave, you would think that the slave would go back to the Israelite master because he would be free after that six-year period, and it would not be as serious a thing as returning the slave to a foreign master. However, if the slave has escaped from his master, that is an indication that the slave is not being treated well. It's an indication. It's not a proof of, but it's at least an indication. So the idea that you've got to turn a slave back to his master and who's not treating his slave well, I would think that's problematical. But that's our first issue. Do you never, ever return slaves to the master? Now, the reason why that's a problem, what happens if you have a slave who's just a deadbeat slave, who is just by his nature somebody that just is not going to obey his master, and he's going to be trouble, and he escapes, and then the slave knows the law that, hey, if I escape, I don't have to be returned to my master. Well, then every slave in Israel would be escaping, and all those laws about the 6 years, in the seventh year, you're released, and all that would be nugatory. Well, let's look at option number two. As far as this handing back over of the escaped slave, the slave is handed back to the master after a period of time. According to this option, this would give the time for the master to cool down, the master who's lost his escaped slave. It would give time for an investigation to be made into the conflict between the master and slave that caused the slave to run away. And so there could be a chance for an accommodation to be made between the master and slave so that peace could be reestablished. John Gill says that this option is most probably the correct option because, it, quote, it cannot be thought that this law was made to encourage and protect every idle, disobedient, and fugitive servant, which would be very sinful and unjust. In other words, the idea that any time a slave escaped, he could never be returned, would encourage idle, disobedient, and fugitive-type slaves, and Gill said the law would not be trying to do that. Now, remember, I need to remind us all that just because the law regulated slavery does not mean that God thought that slavery was a great institution. He didn't think divorce was a great thing either, or polygamy, lots of things, or warfare for that matter, but this he entered into the culture that existed, tried to make it as just as he could. That culture had slavery. He regulated slavery by giving times of remission of the slavery at the year, at the sabbatical year. Well, it actually wasn't the sabbatical year, but it was after 6 years of service. So the terms of servitude were short. And so he regulated slavery. He didn't abolish it. And now he's dealing with runaway slaves. Again, is trying to make it as just as possible. You don't want to completely overthrow the institution because that would screw up the way ancient Near Eastern people did things back then. But on the other hand, you don't want to allow masters to treat their slaves unjustly. So this idea that Gill has that the slave is handed back to his master after a period of time would keep the law from subverting the customs of the ancient Near East and Israel. At the same time, it would give the slave a chance to escape from an angry master for a time so he would not be harmed. Now, as to whether the slave was domestic, a domestic slave or a slave from a foreign country, the NIV Study Bible suggests, or states that it's a foreign slave who escaped to Israel. I don't know how they know that. But Gill cites rabbinic authority to say that this is referring to foreign slaves. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says this, evidently the slave is a servant of the Canaanites or some of the neighboring people who was driven by tyrannical oppression or induced with a view of embracing the true religion to take refuge in Israel. John Gill says the slave could have escaped during a battle with the Israelites. Well, however he got there, he's a foreigner, the foreign slave would not be turned back. Now, on that view, which does make a lot of sense, the idea is foreign slaves could end up living in Israel safely, but it's unlikely that the law would say that you shall not hand a master back over to a Hebrew master. Many people say that the master was idolatrous and the slave was a believer in God, and that's why you didn't return the slave back to the master. Now, I mentioned earlier that the escaped slave, the fact that he's running, shows that the master must have been cruel, or at least it indicates that, because else why would the slave be running if it's not like there's going to be better opportunity economically somewhere else, most probably, for a former slave. So he's probably running from cruelty. It could be, though, the slave had committed a crime. Maybe the slave had killed somebody, decides to take off. But here the law seems to assume that no crime was committed because obviously the law is going to say if somebody's slave committed a crime, you return him so he can face his just deserts. Now the phrase in verse 16, he shall live with you in your midst in the place where he shall choose in one of your towns, that makes it sound like it's a foreign slave, as John Gill says. In other words, as opposed to living over in a foreign country, he shall live in one of your towns. It does make it look like it's a foreign slave that's being spoken of. So what can we say about this verse? It's a little bit fuzzy. In my opinion, I think the probabilities are that this is talking about a foreign slave who is not supposed to be returned to foreign slavery. He's allowed to live in Israel. I think that's the easiest way to interpret it, although it's not a slam dunk. We go now to Deuteronomy 23, verses 17 through 18. None of the daughters of Israel shall be a cult prostitute, nor shall any of the sons of Israel be a cult prostitute. You shall not bring the hire of a harlot or the wages of a dog into the house of the Lord your God for any votive offering, for both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. Now these cult prostitutes, of course, are men or women who, for pay, have sex with a idol worshiper so the idol worshiper can feel like he's getting closer to God. That's kind of how the idea went. You're in union with the prostitute, and the prostitute is in union with God. That's why they're called cult prostitutes as opposed to mere prostitutes. They're doing it for religious, idolatrous purposes, not just for sex. That, of course, is a real bad sin. Let's look at a scripture referring to that in Exodus 34, verses 15 and 16. Otherwise, you might make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they would play the harlot with their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and someone might invite you to eat of his sacrifice, and you might take some of his daughters for your sons. And now we get to the relevant portion of verse 16, Exodus 34. And his daughters might play the harlot with their gods, and cause your sons also to play the harlot with their gods. Well, that could be metaphorical. You're committing spiritual adultery, your sons and daughters. It could be your sons and daughters are actually physically committing harlotry with the demon gods by accepting idolatrous worshipers into their nasty embrace. But at any rate, this is what cult prostitutes did. Verse 18 says, you shall not bring the hire of a harlot or the wages of a dog to the house of the Lord your God. And that's a little bit enigmatic. First of all, why would anybody be bringing the wages of a whore into the temple? Well, the answer to that, according to Adam Clark, is probably referring to the whore herself is bringing the offering. She has sex with the worshiper, and then she takes her earnings, and she gives a portion of her earnings, leaves it right there in the temple as a sacrifice to the god she's bringing the idolatrous worshiper into union with. As Adam Clark says, quote, many public prostitutes dedicated to their gods a part of their impure earnings, and some of these prostitutes were publicly kept in the temple of Venus Melita, whose gains were applied to the support of her abominable worship. I'm not sure which Venus that is, but you get the idea. Now, the wages of a whore or the wages of a dog. What is the wages of a dog? Well, the NIV translates dog as male prostitute. The Hebrew is dog, but what it meant, that's what they call male prostitutes, a dog. Now, the question I have is, these male prostitutes, were they prostituted themselves for the female worshipers who came in and wanted to join themselves to the idol? Or were they prostituting themselves to men homosexually so that the men could join themselves with the idol? I suppose it was both. I mean, if you've gotten this low, prostituting yourself, I don't think the prostitutes really care whether it's a man or a woman. I think a dog was a male prostitute for males. I think that's probably what it was for homosexuals. He's not a male who is prostituting himself by letting females pay him to have heterosexual sex. I mean, there's two ways you can look at it, but I suppose that this means homosexual men worshipers. We go now to Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 through 20. You shall not charge interest to your countrymen, interest on money, food, or anything that may be loaned at interest. You may charge interest to a foreigner, but to your countrymen you shall not charge interest, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land which you're about to possess. Now, this is one of three laws in the Torah, which has led to all kinds of conflict and confusion. It led to all kinds of trouble in the Middle Ages. Businessmen could not borrow money. The church was constantly trying to squash interest, in my opinion, through a misguided reading of the prohibition on interest. And the issue is complicated. Well, let me look at the three verses first. We see in Leviticus 25, you're not supposed to take interest from a poor person. I'll read it to you in a minute. Deuteronomy 15, excuse me, I said that wrong. In Leviticus 25, you don't take interest of a countryman, of a Jewish person, a Hebrew. In Deuteronomy 15, you don't take interest from a poor person. Deuteronomy 23, where we are now, it's not from your countryman, from an Israelite, you don't take interest. So the question is this referring to poor Israelites always? And is it also referring to poor foreigners, these different verses? Or is it, in other words, here are the distinctions you have to make. Is it talking about poor people as opposed to people who can pay a loan? Is it talking about Israelites versus non-Israelites? Or another problem you have is it talking about a charity loan or a business loan? Back then, when people were poor, they would be lent money interest-free, and that would be called a charity loan, whereas a loan for interest would be one that would charge interest. Well, you put all that together, and you end up with a complicated mess. The permutations and combinations of those possibilities create a fertile ground for academic papers. Actually, I found one by a gentleman named Klaus Islett, I think his name was, four-part article. It's very interesting if you really want to get down in the weeds about this issue, but I'm just going to summarize it and say this. In my opinion, the laws are very simple. If you're dealing with Israelites, if it's a charity loan, you don't charge interest. If you're dealing with Israelites and it's a business loan, of course you can charge interest because you can't do business without interest. Now, when it comes to foreigners, whether it's a charity loan or whether it's a business loan, you can charge interest to them. I could be wrong about that, but I think I could be right too. So that's as tight as I'm going to be on this. All right, so let's look at some of the scriptures. Leviticus 25, 35 through 37. Now, in case a countryman of yours becomes poor, and his means with regard to you falter. Well, there in verse 25, I said it was poor, then I said it was countryman. It's actually both countryman, a poor Israelite. Then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. Deuteronomy 15, 7 through 11, if there is a poor man with you, one of your brothers in any of your towns, well, there you have a poor countryman as well. You shall not harden your heart. You shall lend him sufficient for his need. There's the idea of a charity loan, and I won't read all that to simplify things. And then here in Deuteronomy 23, 19 through 20, which is where we are now, you shall not charge interest to your countrymen. There's no mention of poor. Now, the other verses that I read in Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 15 said a poor countryman, a poor Israelite, the poverty part is not mentioned in Deuteronomy 23. I'm just going to assume it was just left out. It's talking about charity loans to poor Hebrews you don't charge interest to, just to keep it simple. To show how this idea of charging interest to poor people, or to Hebrews for that matter, poor Hebrews, was anathema to God, we read in Nehemiah 5, verses 7 through 12. I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, you are exacting usury each from his brother. Therefore I held a great assembly against them. I said to them, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? Then they were silent and could not find a word to say. Again I said, the thing which you are doing is not good. Would you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Lending. Please let us leave off this usury. Usury, of course, means lending at interest. Please give them back to this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. The 100th part of the money and of the grain, the new wine, and the oil that you are exacting from them. Job 24, verse 9 says, others snatch the orphan from the breast, and against the poor they take a pledge. Of course, a pledge is the collateral for a loan. And this is a loan to poor people. Proverbs 28, 8, he who increases his wealth by interest and usury gathers it for him who is gracious to the poor. In other words, you charge interest to the poor people, God's going to take it away from you, and you're going to give it to people who lend money to the poor without charging interest, who make charity loans. Ezekiel 18:13, he lends money on interest and takes increase. Will he live? He will not live. He has committed all these abominations. He will surely be put to death. His blood will be on his own head. Now, there's something. You charge interest and you get your head whacked off. Ezekiel 22, verse 12, in you they have taken bribes to shed blood. You have taken interest in profits. You have injured your neighbors for gain by oppression, for you have forgotten me. Exodus 22, verses 25 through 27. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, again, my people, the poor, sounds like poor Israelites, you are not to act as a creditor. You will not charge him interest. All right, so very clear. You're not supposed to charge interest on charity loans. In my humble opinion, this has no, in fact, I think that's very clear. It has no reference at all to business loans because you can't do business without lending money. In a charity loan, in effect, a gift is made of the interest, but not the principal, because the principal had to be paid back. Now, in the West, we don't have this. We give our charity outright as outright gifts, not as loans. But note the beneficial effect of a charity loan. The poor man is not entirely reliant on charity. He's got some skin in the game. He's got to pay the principal back. This maintains his dignity. He's not a ward of you, the lender, of you, the donor. Now, one little wrinkle we need to look at here. There is a way to interpret one of these laws as to say that interest is allowed even on charity loans. If we look at Leviticus 25, verses 36 and 37, we read this in verse 36, do not take usurious interest from him, which implies that you can take interest from him, but not usurious interest. If you define usurious as excessive, do not take excessive interest from the poor man. You can take reasonable interest from him, but you can't take excessive interest from him. Now, I don't believe that for a minute, but that's has been mentioned. Adam Clark mentions this. But the problem is how do you define what's reasonable? That depends on inflation. That depends on risk, which depends on the borrower's ability to pay. It depends on external economic situations. There's all kinds of things that go into reasonable. The only way you can determine reasonable really is what the market rate is. I don't think that's what it's talking about. I think it's just in general, you don't take interest when you lend money to poor people. Now, the other question is, if that's so, why is it okay to take money from foreigners on a loan? Well, first of all, you got to decide, is it a business loan or is it a charity loan? Well, why would somebody be making a charity loan to a foreigner? I don't know. So I'm assuming that this is a business loan. John Gill, here's some options as to why there was a distinction between the Hebrews making loans to fellow Jews and making loans to foreigners. Option number one, the Israelites were poor foreigners and foreigners were rich traders and therefore they could afford it. That's John Gill's idea, and I don't believe that. But let me give you a quote from somebody who goes along with that idea. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the Israelites lived in a simple state of society and hence they were encouraged to lend to each other in a friendly way without any hope of gain. But the case was different with foreigners who engaged in trade and commerce to borrow to enlarge their capital and might reasonably be expected to pay interest on their loans. Well, I find this argument entirely unconvincing because, for one thing, the context is talking about charity loans to the poor, not commerce. And foreigners are likely to have poor people too. And besides, this idea that the Israelites were a bunch of poor farmers, agricultural people can make a load of money too. I mean, look at Abraham and Job. They were loaded to their gills and they were farmers and herdsmen. If the ability to pay was the reason for the distinction, a lot of rich Jews could pay interest. So I don't think that it's the economic status of foreigners versus Israelites is the reason why there was a distinction, why interest could be taken from foreigners but not from Israelites. I think Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's idea is better. The distinction was to keep the Israelites separate from the business of the rest of the world. Now, I don't know what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mean by that, but I'm just speculating here. Foreigners would not be enticed to come to Israel because of the easy welfare situation. I can go to Israel, I can take a loan, and I can get the loan, and I don't have to pay it back with interest. I get free interest in Israel. I could say I'm poor, could be an actual poverty situation, or maybe even for if you interpret it as referring to business, you could say, well, it's not really a business loan. It's a poverty loan. I'm not going to pay you interest. I don't know. That's speculation. All right. So here's a little summary of the problems in this loan business. First of all, A, if we take the loans to be charity loans, shouldn't we also take foreigners' loans as charity loans? Why not? And if we do take foreigners' loans as charity loans, why should they have to pay interest on their charity loans? Well, I tend to think that the Israelites are not going to be making charity loans to foreigners, unless the foreigners are inside Israel and they're having problems. But at any rate, forcing foreigners to pay interest on charity loans would avoid the easy welfare problem. I remember one time in the 1960s, New York City basically said anybody can get welfare, and half the island of Puerto Rico ended up in New York City, and the city was broke. You do have to be careful about that. We got the same problem here. Half the world's trying to get through our southern border because of all the freebies that the government gives out that the other taxpayers have to pay for, either through taxes or inflation. And so I don't blame them. I mean, if the government's going to be stupid enough to do that, then you're going to come. Well, that's not going to be the case in Israel, because you come into Israel and expect to get interest-free loans, you're not going to get it if you're a foreigner. But at any rate, first problem, are the foreigners' loans charity loans or the business loans? Second problem, if we take the Israelite loans to be charity loans and the foreigners' loans to be business loans and not charity loans, well, then the context gives no clue that the author is switching topics, because he's obviously talking about charity loans with the Hebrews. And then when he switches to foreigners, he would, on this option, be talking about business loans, a sudden switch of topic with no clue. Now, situation three, if we take both Israelite and foreign loans to be business loans, why would there be a ban on interest? For the Hebrews, you have to have interest for commerce to exist. And besides, you read all the scriptures above, it's clear that the loans were charity loans. Now, one way you could get out of that, it means it's a business loan, but you can't take excessive interest, as we said in Leviticus 26, but I don't think that's reasonable. So I think, to summarize, I think it's talking about charity loans in general. You don't charge interest if it's an Israelite. You can charge interest if it's a business loan, although it's not stated. I assume that's a reasonable extrapolation. If you're talking about foreigners, it doesn't matter whether it's charity loan or a business loan. You get to take interest from them. We move now to something that's a little bit easier, Deuteronomy 23, verses 21 through 23. When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be sin in you. You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God, which you have promised. Now, this is talking about voluntary vows. A vow offering, of course, was a kind of peace offering, and it was given in anticipation of God answering a prayer. God, if you let me win this battle, I give you a vow offering, or a votive offering, sometimes it's called. Now, the idea is you don't have to make these type of vows, but if you do it, you pay it. Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 6, when you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. You're a fool if you don't pay up. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. After all, it's voluntary. You don't have to vow. But if you're going to vow, do your vow. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, i.e. the speech that made the vow. Do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Numbers 30, verse 2, if a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Now, all of this assumes, of course, that the vow is not a rash one, that it's a lawful vow, and it's, of course, possible to be performed. There were ways to get out of rash vows, as we talked about it when we were going over vows in somewhere back in the Torah. I forgot exactly where. Note in verse 21, in verse 21, you shall not delay to pay it. Oftentimes, the zeal at the time of a vow dissipates with time, as John Gill says. And the classic example of this is, oh, yes, honey, says the man, I will love you forever and ever and ever. As he's sitting there enamored of her blonde hair and her flat blue eyes and her flashing eyelids. And then, 6 months later, oh, please get away from me. Rash vows are made all the time. And even sincere vows, maybe the man really does love her, but then, whoop, 10 years later, I think I'm going to go to Ashley Madison and get a little something on the side for some excitement. If you make a vow, keep it, and especially marriage vows. You make a marriage vow, it is from death. Excuse me, it's from the time of the marriage until death does you part. Save yourself a lot of grief. You offend God. You offend your spouse. If you commit adultery, there's hardly anything worse than doing that. We go now to Deuteronomy 23, verses 24 through 25. When you enter your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes until you are fully satisfied, but you shall not put any in your basket. When you enter your neighbor's standing grain, then you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. Now, why would you enter your neighbor's vineyard? Well, here's some options from John Gill. You could be taking a walk, a recreational walk. You may be checking to see how the vines were flourishing after the owners invited you over there to look at his fields. Most probably, you're just passing by the vineyard on the way to somewhere else. Now, this law definitely made it easier to travel. They didn't have roadside conveniences like we've got now, you know, the Stuckey's and the Cracker Barrels and all that kind of thing that you can stop at on the way when you're traveling. When they traveled by foot, they could just pluck some grapes on the way back. Now, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says, the quantity plucked was a loss never felt by the proprietor, and it was a kindly privilege afforded to the poor and wayfaring man. The reason the proprietor never felt the loss is because the person getting the grapes couldn't get a basket full. You shall not put any in your basket. You got to eat one at a time till your stomach is filled up. That's a small amount. If you allow him to put it in his basket, he's basically reaping, just like he's a farmer in business, and he didn't sow. And that would be unfair and unjust. Ladies and gentlemen, well, in verse 25, let me say this too before I go. Verse 25, the same thing is true of plucking wheat as you go by. If you pluck the heads with your hand, it's not like you're reaping your neighbor's crops. You're just getting a few extra things that he's not going to notice. But you shall not wield a sickle. That means you're going in there and taking all of his crops that you did not plant. Now, this might remind you of a scripture, Matthew 12:1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. Now, there was nothing wrong with picking the grains and eat by the disciples. That is sanctioned by this law right here, Deuteronomy 23, verse 25. Now, nothing is said in Deuteronomy 23, verse 25 about working. But it's clear. The law has nothing to do with working. It says you shall not wield a sickle. That would be work. This is just picking something as you walk by. And so these pin-headed Pharisees looked at Jesus and the disciples and said, "Hey, you're working. You're working on the Sabbath because you're picking the heads of grains of wheat." Such utter nonsense. And of course, Jesus let the Pharisees hold it like he always did. It always warms my heart to see legalists beat upside the head verbally. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with chapter 23 of Leviticus. This prepares us for our foray into our next chapter, Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 22. We'll look at the laws concerning divorce and other miscellaneous laws. Hope to see you then. Hope you enjoyed this audio.